And then he was like, should we both leave then together? And I was like, what? He was like, yeah, I'll leave as well. And I was like, why would you do that?
Yeah, this is the CEO of the London office for this agency. This is the same meeting where he's offered you the job. And
the same
you
meeting.
Said no. And he's then gone, all right, if you're leaving, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
Both he and my friends said to me, why wouldn't you do it? And I said, well, what if they laugh? The sort of reaction to me when I said, well, you know, what if they think I'm crazy or whatever? It's like, well, who cares? What's the worst they do? They say no. What does that matter?
I knew my mother was really upset, but then they encouraged me to do it. They're like, do it. It's the right thing for you. So, can we break this? We're going to have a bit of crying.
Yes, of course.
I wouldn't say I was suicidal, but I felt like, I can't do this. I am losing it. My brain is not taking it in anymore.
I'm not a creative. I am creative. I'm creative, but I'm not a creative.
Well, clearly, you know, people were seeing something special. And one of those people would be Dan. Mm-hmm. So he is CEO of this company you join. You're an intern. Mm-hmm. And they're doing they do a reverse or a mentoring
No, they.
The company?
No, they didn't. They didn't. Although Dan did interview me, though. He was one of the interviewed. It was him and another guy called Dave Austin, who was the senior planner.
That's the first time you met Dan in that interview.
I'd met him. No, I'd also met him when we visited. So actually, to be fair, he was actually quite hands-on as a CEO during the process of the program. So he wanted to know like who the interns were. He met them. He had come down to the interview process. So, and it was a big deal at the time because I didn't have a relationship with him at all. So we were like, whoa, the CEO's gone, like this must be a big thing, like, do you know what I mean? But he was mad cool and he was really curious, and I think that's why we got on anyway. I started like a newsletter to just talk about the stuff that I was into. I sent it around every week on a Friday called the Urban Lowdown. And it was all about Black culture and everything that was happening in my world and everything that I was into outside of advertising. So that was music, fashion, anything that I felt was just really cool, to be honest. Anything that I just thought, this is sick. Like, I'm going to share this. So, and I remember things like Drake dropping Views, Skepta dropping Konnichiwa, like selling out just things that were happening that I thought, this is sick. Like, we should know about stuff like this. Willow Smith had just become the first teen Black ambassador for Chanel, like just stuff like that that I just was like, this is so interesting. I'd interviewed Slick Rick at the time because I joined Guap, and obviously if anyone knows Slick Rick, he's like a hip-hop legend. Like, so I was just like, you know what, I'm gonna share all of this. And the more I shared, the more requests I got, like, is this going to be a weekly thing? Like, what? Like, we want to know more what's going on.
Who's requesting? Who's saying that?
Everyone in the agency. Like, right. I don't even know some of the people. I don't even know some of the people. I just used to get, like, Kelly from HR would be like, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it was just random.
And this is an internal newsletter, is it?
Yeah. Okay. Internal. Okay. I just write it every Friday. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, save it to my Urban Lowdown. And then, like, I'd go to an event and I'd write about it. Or I'd hear a talk and I'd write about it, or I'd listen to like TED Talks or something, and I'd analyze it a little bit, and I'd take out like some key points. And it was my way of like kind of extending, like, okay, this is what I'm good at, or this is what I'm really into, and this is what I can do really well. And at the time, like, I literally knew like all the hotspots for like underground hip hop raves in London, or like any new artists that were coming through at the time. Like, and then I actually organized a breakfast that I was asked to meet the creative department, and it was about all the like next like talent that's going to be like popping in the next 4 to 5 years. And that was like Guap, who are obviously doing amazing right now, Jasmine Sarah, who's an incredible artist, Colby Martin, another incredible artist, Shay Lingo, who's a sick rapper. But they all came in to meet Iris. That was like my first like responsibility off the back of that Urban Lowdown. Like, okay. And I was just like, yeah, like, as an advertising agency, we should know these people. Like, and like, yeah. And I suppose it's like a result of like also where they are now, because, you know, they've gone on to work with some incredible agencies, brands, etc. And I suppose the agency itself, Dan in particular, started to be like, okay, I really understand why this is important for us as an agency that talks about culture and talks about being in culture, but actually, are we? Like, are we really? And then he just started booking in meetings with us. Well, his PA started booking in meetings, and then we started having like catch ups. And then I remember I got asked to do like my first public speaking gig, and that was like a agency of 2020 by Creative Social. I don't think they're around anymore. And I did a presentation, and that was like a prediction of like the next 4 years. And he came, and then Dan. Dan mm-hmm. came, and then he wrote about it. He actually wrote a long essay about my talk, sent it around to the whole agency, and I was like, whoa, like, that's a big deal. And I'd just then get random people stopping me in the agency like, excuse me, are you Shanice, the one who like, yeah. And I suppose off the back of that, I became more confident, and I felt a lot more empowered about what I was good at and what I felt like I really cared about. And then they offered me a job.
Was it an official kind of mentoring relationship going on, or he would just book meetings and you would talk about, what would you talk about? What was the, how
was
did it go?
Official? I mean, probably was official, because it was like routined and like, it, quote unquote, like there was a consistency to it.
Yeah. But it wasn't like an official mentoring program.
Yeah,
let's say.
No, yeah, yeah. But it was that program. Yeah,
he thought, okay, this person's interesting. You know, I'd like to understand this, a bit more about it, because I see the value in it for us as an agency, because we're talking about culture. But I'm now realizing we probably weren't doing much about culture or knew about culture.
Yeah.
And Shani's come along and gone, this is culture. This is what's going on. And so he has these meetings with you, and then you're still in internship, and then what happens? Tell us about when he offers you a job.
Yeah, just going back to what you said about like, no, probably not. I think they were doing interesting things, but I think they weren't on the pulse as much as they thought they were. So I think it's more a case of like, for a wider context, the brands that they were working with were like asking them to do stuff or source things, and they were like, oh, we have the ability to source this, but actually we should have the ability to do this at pace. And it wasn't happening at pace. It was like going through different loops and hoops. And then like, I would talk to like the creative director, for example, on Adidas, and he'd be like, ah, I'm looking for some MCs in Manchester. Do you know any? And I'm like, yeah, of course I do. What? Like, that's my bread and butter. Do you know what I mean? And he'd be like, all right, cool. And then like, they realized that, okay, that's what we need in the agency. People who we can just go and have a conversation with across the desk, rather than taking all these processes and to different agencies or agents and stuff. So I think it was more about, there's something here about process and structure that isn't quite right when it comes to connecting to culture. And Shanice is showing us that we have the ability to bridge that gap if we wanted to. And then Dan, I suppose, got more intrigued about that. And he would just ask me stuff like, you know, where do I come from? Like, what am I into? What else am I doing outside of this? He would ask me about Guap, because I was also working at Guap. He was, you know.
Tell us about, just briefly, what is Guap?
So Guap at the time was the world's first video magazine. And they are all about established and emerging creatives, so putting them on. At the time, it was mostly in and around music, but now they're a multi-platform. So they have like a podcast studio. They also have their agency called GA. They still have their magazine. And then they also just put out content. So at the moment, for example, they have their mentoring program that they're running with Adidas Originals.
And they're Kurt Geiger's agency.
And they are also Kurt Geiger's lead agency now, yes. But initially, I'd started with them doing like brand and talent management. So when I was doing all of that, it was super cool, because I was writing, and I was like sourcing like volunteers for writers and editors, etc.
Was this were you full-time internship at Iris?
At Iris.
So how were you doing that and Guap?
I don't know. I was just I don't know, I was just hustling. I don't know, yeah. Just balancing the two, I think. And I was just taking what I knew and exchanging it. And then, like I said, bringing them in there. And then, yeah, I think he offered me a job. And he was like, he goes, I'm going to offer you a job. We do want to keep you. We don't actually know what the title is, but we do want to keep you. So, what do you say? And honestly, I was really happy that they were or wanted to consider me, but I just couldn't do it. I was just like, yeah, nah. I said, I appreciate it, but I'm going to have to decline.
Yeah, so why?
Yeah, you've got this great opportunity. You know, it's like job, salary, your life, get on the career ladder. Lots of people wouldn't think twice, and they'd just be like, yes, let's do it.
You're a celeb in the agency. People are stopping you.
What made Shannon go, thank you, but no.
Yeah, it was literally thank you, but no, thank you.
Can you remember what was going through your mind?
I think at the time I just thought, like, this is sick. Like, I've actually surprised myself even. Like, amazing. However, my day-to-day is not what I imagined it to be. I'm not excited every day. I don't get that much responsibility because the reality is I'm an intern and these that don't rate me. So you rate me, but you don't really. Like, do you know what I mean? I had some instances in the agency itself where I didn't feel comfortable with.
Like what?
Just like small stuff. Like, I remember vividly someone telling me that, you know, I think you should consider reading more Grazia in OK Magazine. Because, you know, you just need to open up your mind a bit. And I was like, are you joking?
Ironic.
I was thinking that, are you joking? That you've got to be joking. Everyone in this agency reads OK and Cosmopolitan. I'm literally the only person that's probably picking up a Vice or Hunger Magazine. And you want me to open up my mind? Like, what? Like, you just find yourself having really strange conversations like that. And you think to yourself, wow, okay. Nah, like, this is not the place for me then. Like, it's just not the place for me. The clients were very mainstream. So although the audiences, some of them would have been targeted at maybe young black boys in football. But that wouldn't have been like the main target audience, because at the end of the day, they still got to sell like a boot, which is a universal like football boot. So in fairness to them, they weren't always trying to target like, you know, black people or Muslim culture or anything like that. But it was a case of them feeling like they knew if they got that brief, they knew that, oh yeah, we could do that. When the reality is they probably couldn't. But at the same time, I also don't think it was a conscious decision. I think it was an unconscious thing. Like, yeah, like, of course we have the ability to do this. We're one of the best agencies in London. So why wouldn't we take on this challenge? Not knowing that the challenge is a structural challenge. Like, you need to take that on in a structural context inside the agency in order to take on that. And I think a lot of these things I would express like around to Dan, like, I've got no problem working here, like, I feel like you're a sick agency, but the reality is that it's not my world. Like, and I don't know how welcoming you would be to my world, because I'm still getting told that I need to read OK Magazine, and there's obviously a mentality here where I find myself, I'd probably have to defend myself a lot of the time rather than feel like, oh yeah, I can bring new ideas to the table. Do you know what I mean? So it's great me sending a newsletter around and everyone reading that on a Friday, but ultimately, how many of these ideas are we going to implement that back into the work? Do you know what I mean?
And you're someone, obviously, from your life who's been about taking action and making a difference from 14 years old.
Exactly. And obviously they didn't have that context. So they really did not see, to be honest, Dan probably even seen more of my potential than I even saw my potential. But again, it was just like, oh yeah, but she's like, how old is she? She's like 21, 22. Like, what does she know? Like, do you know what I mean?
So you say to Dan politely, no, thanks. What do you think is going through his mind?
Huh? Like, he's like, okay. Okay, why not? Like, and you know what? He was great about it, actually. He was like, he asked me why. I think I said why And then he was like, all right, then cool. He was like, you know what? Fair enough. Fair enough. And then he was like, should we both leave then together? And I was like, what? He was like, yeah, I'll leave as well. If you're going to leave, I'll leave as well. And he literally said that. And I was like, but why would you do that?
So let's just be clear. This is the CEO of this, of the London office for this agency. This is the same meeting where he's offered you the job.
Mm-hmm.
And the same meeting. You said no. And he's then gone, all right, if you're leaving, I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm. Just like that.
And then what happened?
And then he was like, okay, I've got to have some conversations first. But he was just like, but ultimately, let's do it. I didn't believe him, if I'm honest. I was a bit like, okay, but why would you do that? That, like, me turning down a job, an internship at junior level, I can kind of understand. I get why people would be like, why are you doing that? But I can kind of understand what you walking away from your C-suite six-figure salary makes no sense to me. Like, what? Like, why would you do that?
And he'd been in that job at the time, what, since 2011, I think he became CEO?
Yeah, like 14 years. Like, he'd been CEO for about 7 years, but he'd been in the job about 14 years. So, again, it's like, huh?
He'd been managing director of the Shanghai office.
Yeah, he opened all the office, well, most of the offices around the world, Singapore, wow. Sydney, like, and
so this intern comes in, says, I'm leaving. He's like, okay, I'm off too.
Yeah, ultimately. And he'll be like, oh, like, you know, if you talk to him, he'll be like, oh, it's all Shani's fault. Like, why we started the agency. But ultimately, like, no, he's great because it takes a lot, I think. And even just like when we talk about, like, it's hard enough as a young business being taken seriously and saying that you're going to, like, you know, change advertising. Mm-hmm. And it's hard enough just having that mission and being whoever you are. Never mind me being some 22-year-old from Birmingham, like, no experience in the advertising world. And then him has this experienced middle-class white man saying, oh yeah, this is my co-founder, by the way, and she's going to be handling all the talent. Like, look at him, like, are you crazy? Like, what? Like, who qualified this person? Like, so I feel like he really took a risk on himself just doing that, because, like, at this point, it's past allyship. That's advocacy. You're an accomplice at this point. Do you know what I mean? And I think for me, it was just more a case of like, okay, well, you really got to do this then. Like, you say you're about it and you've been saying that you're about it. So this challenge is a real challenge. And then we did, like, we sort of just, yeah.
But what, on that day, did you tell your mother?
Yep.
What did she say?
I called my mom. She's like, no, I don't trust him. Don't trust him. Like, she was literally like, and my mom is obviously at the first meet, she was a bit of a pessimist. But, like, I think she was just a bit like, huh? I don't even understand why you would do that. Like that makes no sense to me. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I don't know what to do. Like, what do I do? And she was just like, well, I'll talk to him again, and then get it in writing. Like, she was like, I just like, what? Like, and then I did. We spoke again. In fact, we spoke every day after that.
Really?
Yeah.
In person?
In person, yeah. In person. And then we were going back for, like, the, you know, like the Christmas period, like where you have like a week and a half off. I was going back to Birmingham. So I went back to Birmingham and he sent me a phone in the post and said, this is your work phone. See you when you get back.
Wow. What phone was it?
Oh, it was like an iPhone 5, I think.
Wow,
nice.
Yeah, at the time. I mean, this was like 7 years ago.
Yeah, that was the team.
But yeah, but to me, it could have been a Nokia 3310. Like, I was just like, whoa, like, do you know what I mean? Like, what is, like, okay, this is a serious thing. And first of all, I had never been on one of them people to be having work phones and personal phones. Even that was new for me, like, what? So even that was like just new transitions, do you know what I mean? And new waves of working. And then, yeah, moved back. And then we started, we didn't even know what it was called at the time, to be fair. It was just an agency.
And he'd put in his notice at this point, or?
Well, not really. But he had began conversation because Iris were our original investors. So, yeah. Yeah. At that point, then you gave. Yeah.
Okay. So Iris invested in the company you started together.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, you got a question?
No, carry on there. You're in the flow.
So you get together. He sent you a phone, and you incorporate the company in 2017. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And you start trading
June 2017.
By June, and the first conversation you'd had about starting a company was when?
November
2016. So it's about six months.
Yeah.
The company was up and running. Mm-hmm. And you brought on three other co-founders, is that right? Yeah. Who are they?
So we had a creative director. Her name is Kate Assumption. Chris Grimwood as client director, and Will DeGroot, who is culture strategist.
Okay.
So we worked together like quite intensely, for the first 2 to 3 years. Yeah.
Wow. So there's five of you at the beginning, and got some investment. And what was that first year like? What do you remember? How were you feeling?
It was just a whirlwind. Like, even thinking about it now, we worked on some really like projects we just wouldn't work on again. But not necessarily because they were bad, just because they were just video projects and content. Like, you know, like small stuff just to get us going. And to be fair, our biggest client and our founding client was Dyson.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working on the air purifiers, and we had teams up in Malmesbury working with the client directly, and that was still a really big deal for us because it's like, one, it's Dyson, and they've the ones that taken a really big chance on us, and we have the story to talk about that and the case studies to talk about that. The more we started talking and the more we started doing stuff, the more we started venturing into like, oh, could we do a music video? So we also did a music video, and it was like, oh, can we do some video content for like this recruitment company? And we did a video content for, and it was just a bit random. Like, everything was just a bit random, but also everything aligned to what we believed in as well. Like, we were practicing the idea of like, you know, building teams that made sense for the project and being representative. And we started putting on our creative storyteller events. And our first one was at Red Bull. And I remember saying, yeah, we're going to sell out. And we did. And we had a great speaker lineup of like entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs talking about bringing ideas to reality, which is essentially where we were starting from. And then when Red Bull co-signed us, it was like, okay, yes, sick. Where are we going to go next? And then Twitter offered us their space. And then after Twitter offered us their space, we said, all right, cool. We got Converse as a client. Can they offer? And then they offered. And then we started to build a real credibility around like brands and like talking about the things that we really wanted to be doing. And then we were doing research, and we were doing it our own back, and we were building relationships with like universities and colleges and sixth forms and stuff, and doing talks. And I think that proactivity around us as an agency just trying to build a message around inclusivity then allowed us to then tap into clients as well, because clients were like, oh, okay, yeah, sick. And that's where community building came in for me anyway, because we built a real community, and we have built a real community around the guest list and like just everything that we have, so people really trust us with that.
So you've gone on to start 1 month mentors.
Yes.
Which originally was like a pilot. You ran it for a month in Black History Month in what year was
2020.
That? 2020. And that's gone on, you've gone on to partner with Clarks on that project, right?
Yep.
Tell us a bit about how that developed and evolved, and was that your idea? And it's in July 2020. Do you hear about a role as a CEO?
I do.
And what's your first thought? Yes, I'm ready. Let's go for it. I am ambitious, no matter what the tests say. Or do you feel like, oh, am I ready?
So I read the email. So there was an internal email saying we are looking to fill this role. I knew the person who was leaving the role. We worked together. And I read it and I saved it, but I thought about it for a while. And at some point, I think I spoke to one of my closest friends in the business and said, they're hiring for this role. I was thinking about maybe I should put my name for it. Of course you should. I don't know. Had a similar conversation with my husband.
What did he say?
Both he and my friends said to me, why wouldn't you do it? And I said, well, what if they laugh?
What if they laugh?
Yeah.
At you for applying for the role?
And I don't, you know, and I like I say that now and I laugh at myself a little bit, but I think it was exemplary. I was, you know, I was not particularly connected into the mainframe. I was at an MD level, you are one step below being connected into that on a regular basis. And so it does feel a bit distant. Didn't
what do you mean
this.
Connected to the mainframe?
So, oh, sorry. That's not it. But like, so at, if once you're at that CEO level, you are not only running your agency, but you are part of the senior leadership team across all the Dentsu brands. So you are more connected in with the sort of the main leadership of Dentsu, the holding company, as well as, you know, so the UK CEO, you know, all the people who sit in the center in very high leadership positions. They don't typically aren't very well connected to anyone below that CEO level on a day-to-day basis. I mean, so certainly.
So that's a room you're not, you haven't really been in before.
Not much.
So and you feel like, oh, who am I to apply for this role?
Which is, so they're going to go, you know. And Dentsu X was an interesting one. And one of the reasons I did feel like I should apply for it is at the time, Dentsu X was still an integrated creative and media shop. And that is my... Ironically, it's my sweet spot. After years of trying to prove to people that I was one or the other, that actually because I've been both, that puts you in a really rather unique category. I knew at some point it would make me marketable. That's not true, by the way. I never thought it would, but it did finally turn into being a positive. But so the sort of reaction to me when I said the, well, you know, what if they think I'm crazy or whatever, is like, well, who cares? What's the worst they do? They say no. What does that matter? Okay. This is actually all in my head because nobody's going to think me silly for having done it. So I decided to put my myself forward. So I sent an email to the two people on there and said I'd like to throw my hat in the ring. Turns out that had I not done it that night, they were closing it the next day.
Really? Mm. Wow. Yeah.
So cue the dramatic
just
music.
Got in.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm so glad I did it. Obviously, for a million reasons, but
can you share what the process was like? So you send me on saying, "Yeah, I'll up and throw my hat in the ring," and what happens next?
So they ask for your resume, sorry, your CV, and the first thing I realized is like, I don't actually have an up to date CV because I wasn't looking for a job. But no, they so there were it was a really not it wasn't an incredibly long process. My first meeting was with our chief client officer for Dentsu and then the head of HR for the UK. And they were sort of the first cutoff point. I remember getting the call from the chief client officer saying, I'm really thrilled to tell you you've made it through the next round. And I was like, it was because it was during COVID, it was a video call. So I couldn't let my jaw drop like I wanted to, but I was like, oh, that's amazing. But
are you still thinking at this point, they're not going to take me seriously? Or
I, you know, at this point what I'm thinking, so it was really interesting, that first meeting was really important in the process for me because what I decided going into it was that I wanted to be sure that I at no point you can prepare for an interview like a test. You can study a bunch of stuff you didn't know the day before, you can learn it, you can cram it, you can go in and sound like an expert. Sometimes we're going to know that you've done that, sometimes we're not, but it's not impossible to go in and kind of blag your way through. And what I wanted to make sure is that at no point I felt like I was doing that. So I wanted to make sure that throughout the entire thing, I knew the answers, or the answers I were giving were authentic to me, or I admitted I didn't know it. Because what I didn't want to be was getting the job on false pretenses, because I knew that would really suck. Like that I'd eventually get found out. And that first interview was really cool because at the end of it, I didn't feel like I had to blag anything. I felt happy with how I'd done, and I felt authentic. Like I felt like I'd answered authentically. And if they didn't think I was right for the job, cool. But I don't, you know, I was proud of myself. I sort of felt like, you know, I've done all right. And that was kind of how I wanted to feel. That I realized that's just, if I feel like that throughout this process, then cool. And if I get it, great. And if I don't, like, I was still really not thinking it was like it's a big deal. Like that's a big title. Yeah. So I just was sort of like, yeah, okay. Keep taking that. So I so the second call was actually with the man who is my boss now. And in prep for that, what they basically had me do is they was like, answer this question. What will you do as CEO of Dentsu X?
Oh, that's a big question.
It's a huge
question.
Considering
you've never been a CEO before.
Yeah.
So I just decided I would.
Do you Google it?
No, I didn't. I just said, you know what, I'm gonna write I'm going to present my 90-day plan. And actually, that made it a 100-day plan because there's when you typical of the U.S. presidency, there's always like a 100-day plan. And then, you know, and so I was like, I'm American. I'll say it's a 100-day plan.
How did you know to do that? Did you just read it in a book? I
have no idea.
You just decided.
It just made sense.
Okay. Was it something that you'd done perhaps before ever?
No, I needed something to organize my thinking. And so that's what I did. Now, ironically, when I spoke to my boss after I had the job, he said, I did the same thing. I did it. Or actually he told me in that interview, he goes, I wrote a 90-day plan.
Okay. You're like, good. I've made the right decision.
And then I used something.
What was his role, by the way, the person interviewed?
So he is the CEO of the media line of business at Dentsu. Okay. He was very funny. I had this whole, you know, PowerPoint deck and he literally, I don't think I showed him three slides. He just started asking me questions and you never saw, I had a slide that said that, but it was a brilliant conversation. Mm. And again, I didn't feel like I had to make anything up. I didn't feel like he was asking me a question where I was like, you know, the duck under the water going, crap, you know. So much of it was about leading people. So much it was about how do you come into an organization that we know right now is in the midst of a massive transformation, is, you know, has had a lot of identity change. How do you, you know, all of that. And it was stuff that I was just, you know, it was my heartland. It was the stuff that I really believed in. It was also really important to acknowledge that I didn't have the answers, like necessarily. I was going to try things, and if they didn't work, we were going to evolve them. But post that, I met with our UK CEO, and I'd met with the global CEO of Dentsu X. But by then, I was aware I was in the sort of final consideration set. And it's funny, it switches from I think I could do this to I want to do this to I really hope they give me the job.
Because by this point, you've put all this, you've put a 100-day plan together and
you believe you can do it. You've
thought about getting the role for so long. Yeah. What do you remember about the day? How did they let you know?
I got a call saying we want to offer you the job, which was brilliant. And, you know, I remember, so I was in a different part of our house to where my husband was. And it's just sort of, he knew, I'm not sure if it was a scheduled call or not. So I just was sitting there for a minute kind of going. And then I, you know, walked in and it's like, they offered me the job.
Nice.
And it, you know, it was awesome. And it continues to be. Like, I'm so proud of this job. I love this job. I love what I get to do for a living. It's awesome. But it was, you know, it was an achievement I never really realized I wanted to have. Mm. And, you know, any job you get should feel like that, right? This just happened to feel like that. And it has a really cool title associated with it. But it was, yeah, it's epic.
So considering you've never done this job before, you know, you start and you're now the boss of the company. Everybody's looking to you. What do you do? Again, do you Google? What do you do on your first day as CEO? How does it work? Does someone take you through and show you what to...
Amend that to what do you do on your first day as CEO in COVID?
Tell us, before building up to before the 14th of February 2013, what was your relationship with Oscar? And tell us a bit about him.
So Oscar, I mean, Oscar was he was seen as the world's number one athlete. Lovely guy. Lovely, lovely guy.
Full stop, not Paralympic athlete.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, I remember meeting him for the first time in New Zealand. Great guy. And he was like, yay, Quig, I've heard you joined the IPC, good to see you. And then we had a really good relationship. We'd exchange WhatsApps, or at that time it was SMSs.
So how often would you be seeing him?
At events. So when he was competing in Paralympic sport events, or World Championships, and maybe at the Paralympic Games we met him. So in London 2012, obviously the build up to those games, he competed in the Olympics, then the Paralympics. And then, yeah, he was a great advocate of Paralympic sport. We didn't need to do too much with him because he had his own team around him building his profile. So our focus was more on people who could potentially beat him or other athletes in other, because we've got to imagine that the Paralympics isn't just about blade runners, it's all the other athletes and all the other sports. So we built a strategy of ones to watch in every single sport, because a lot of people who were coming to the Paralympics were like, I don't know where to begin, who should I be watching? So we did athlete profiles of all the best athletes in the sports who were good media talkers, who the media could report on. And then we let Oscar with his team live by their own devices, because they were doing enough comms as it was.
So, and how big was he?
He was huge. He was like, wherever you went, people took notice of him. He was a rock star at the time. And he also inspired a lot of athletes to, I mean, you ask a generation of Paralympians around that time, why did you get into Paralympic sport? And they'll say, Oscar Pistorius inspired me.
And what was your relationship with him?
It was good. We had a good working relationship. We'd, like I say, we'd exchange messages. If he had concerns, he'd ring me or he'd message me. And yeah, it was a good relationship like I'd have with any other athlete.
So talk us through the 13th of February 2013.
Yeah,
what were the events?
You're in Toronto.
Yeah, I was in Toronto. We were on a site visit for the Pan American Games. I think the night of the 13th, I'd been out for some drinks with the Canadian Paralympic Committee, probably a few too many drinks. Got to bed, determined to sleep. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. And people don't ring you at 2 o'clock in the morning with good news. And it was and I'd missed the call. And then I saw a message from my brother just saying, oh boy, you're going to be busy today. And I'm like, what? And then I rang the journalist back and he said, look, there's reports in South Africa that Oscar Pistorius has shot dead his girlfriend. And I just remember freezing, thinking, bloody, what? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, he's mistaken her for an intruder in the house and he's shot her dead. And you're thinking, oh my God. First time in my life someone I knew had been involved in something like that. And you just froze. And then I was thinking, my brother's right, this is going to be the hardest day of work ever. So then we went into crisis mode, which was like, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning in Toronto. And then it was like, how do we get through this? So then I phoned our chief executive who was in Toronto with me.
Is that the first person you call?
Yeah, yeah. Rang him. I said, look, to the journalist, I'll come back to you. And by this time, every journalist in the world is ringing me. It's difficult to make a call on your mobile phone when your phone doesn't stop ringing. So I used the hotel phone to ring our chief exec and said, look, Xavi, I'm sorry, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, but this has happened. And he was like, oh, shit. And then I phoned Sir Philip, our president, who was in Bolton, well, in Cheshire at the time. It was still early morning. I think it was like 7 o'clock UK time. He was in bed and he said, no one rings me at 7 o'clock in the morning with good news. And I told him what had happened and he was like, oh, blimey. And then we just said, look, I remember sitting down with the team and I just had a few discussions with people like on the phone. I said, look, we've got to be really careful here because a lot of people were going out with statements saying, oh, I can't, poor Oscar mistaken his girlfriend for this. And I was like, we've got to be really careful here because if it transpires that it wasn't an accident and we've been shown lots of sympathy, then we're going to get hammered. So let's play the long game here. And I remember our statement was very generic about sympathy for the deceased and their family members.
What was your thinking behind that? Why did you say that?
Just, you never know. You never know. I mean, all you've got is someone's dead. Something tragic has happened. And you've got to be really, I always think in communications, it's a bit like a game of chess. It's so strategic. You've always got to think one step ahead. And that's what I was thinking was like, we've got to be really careful here. So we were super careful. We issued a statement. And then in crises, I always think that you shouldn't shy away. You've got to try fill air time. So we pretty much did every interview that was requested of us. And interestingly, on that day in Toronto, we were due to do a media day where we'd set up 20 interviews with Canadian media to talk about the Pan American Games. And I remember the director of communications for the organizing committee in Toronto ringing me going, do you want to cancel? I went, no, we'll do them all.
And that's a brave decision.
Yeah, and he was like, why? And I said, we'll talk about it. So we talked about how, and the reason why we did that is we realized, look, regardless of what's happened here, Oscar's clearly probably not going to be competing soon. And we needed to show that the Paralympic movement wasn't just about one person. So we filled the airtime. We said, look, our sympathies are with the deceased and the family of Reva Steenkamp. We filled all the airtime that we needed to, talking about how the Paralympic movement was more than one athlete. And it was the most unbelievable, surreal day. And I remember, I think at one point I had 122 missed calls on the phone, like umpteen voicemail messages. And it was scary because you were part of the biggest news story on planet Earth.
How was that for you personally?
It's difficult. Mentally, it's really difficult because someone you know has shot someone. But then you've got to put that to one side and do what is best for your organization. So all the thoughts and emotions you've got, you've got to put to one side. By the time I got onto the plane to fly home, I'd been awake for 36 hours.
You must have been drained.
Yeah, and I remember embracing Chavi before, like we got changed just before we went to the thing. And I remember we just cried on each other. That was we got 30 seconds where we just embraced and cried. All the emotion came out. And then we got to the airport and we went to the airport lounge and we're like, at least we can maybe relax now because we've given all the interviews. And I remember the 10 o'clock news coming on in the evening in the lounge in the hotel, in the airport. And every TV had either me or our chief executive on TV talking about what had happened. And everyone just looked at us like that. And obviously then people wanted to talk about it. And we didn't. And then we didn't want obviously to talk about it. And I remember getting on the plane exhausted. And the plane had engine trouble on the runway and I kept drifting off like this. And every time I drifted off, I started hallucinating and a little pixie would run up the corridor of the plane and slap me around the face and wake me up. And this happened for like 45 minutes. And there was no one sat next to me. And then there was a little old lady sat in the window. And I kept saying, have you seen that pixie? Did you see that? And she was really concerned.
I bet.
Really, really concerned. And she was like, what the hell am I sat next to here?
Why did that happen?
Just exhaustion.
Sleep deprivation.
Just complete exhaustion. Because I'd not slept. No, I've never had it again. And it was like, and then I fell asleep. As soon as the plane took off, I slept. And it was a 7-hour flight back to Frankfurt. And I think for 5 hours, I slept solid. And then I woke up and the old lady next to me went, put her arm on, her arm reached over. She went, are you okay, dear? And I said, yeah, I am. I said, what happened last night? And she said, you were hallucinating. And she said, you claimed there was a pixie. And I told her, I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'd not slept for 36 hours. Explained what I'd been involved in. She went, oh, do you know what? When we took off, I asked to move because I thought you were either a drunk or a drug addict because you were making no sense. You were so incoherent.
Well, that makes sense for her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I can imagine it. So I remember then landing in Frankfurt and I switched my phone off, which I very rarely do. And I slept for 18 hours solid.
Wow.
And then the next day I rang Sir Philip and I rang Chavi and I said, look, we need to go on the offensive here because a lot of people are speculating that this could be the end of the growth of the Paralympic movement because the superstar athlete has been arrested. And I said, we've got to go out and tell the world that the movement still exists and the fact that Oscar, when he came to London 2012 Paralympics, he didn't win gold in the 100. He was beaten by Johnny Peacock. In the 200, he was beaten by Alan Oliveira and he won the gold in the 400. So we've got to show the world that we are bigger than one athlete. And we went a little bit on the front foot and we were talking about how the movement, we still felt that the movement could grow and that we would build towards Rio and London had given this new generation of superstar athletes. And that's how we got through it. And then obviously every time the court case came up, we'd get the media coming to us. And one of the learning experiences that I remember getting hammered for an interview I did on the BBC with Nikki Campbell where... It's one of those things where they clip the sound bites. And I described Oscar Pistorius as an inspiration to many athletes. And I remember them saying, but he's murdered someone, Craig. He's been found guilty of murdering someone. And I was like, yeah, but there's multiple athletes who have taken up Paralympic sport because of this man. Very rarely does someone uninspire you. So like those athletes who'd been inspired to take up Paralympic sport didn't suddenly... decide that we're going to give up Paralympic sport because of what had happened in South Africa. So that was and then I got hammered on social media. This is where the trolls came out. And I remember it was really upsetting for me personally. And I just like, I'm obsessed by social media. And for a weekend, I just didn't go on Twitter. And then my parents were seeing some of the abuse I was getting on social media. Like, this guy's got no heart. He's just described a murderer as an inspiration.
And, how does that feel?
Oh, hideous. Hideous. The trolls on social media. I mean, I've had it a few times, but it's just like, that was my first experience of it.
It must be so hard because it's so easy to say the wrong thing
or yeah.
say the things that are
going to... Totally. And I wanted to correct myself on social media going, look, someone doesn't uninspire people. They might have a very different view of the person because of what's happened, but you don't uninspire people. These people are still doing sport. But then I just thought, do you know what? When the trolls start, you're never going to win. The moment you start to interact with them, game over. So I just kept my head down for the weekend, stayed at my parents, chilled out. They were really great with me. And then it was just back to planning.
How did you plan for those interviews? How do you prepare for interviews where you know there's a lot of things I could say that are going to be wrong or bad or make the company or myself?
Yeah, I always think on crisis communications, you should always try fill the airtime if someone's giving you the opportunity, if you've got something to say. Because if you don't go out and say it, all they'll do is go get a talking head from elsewhere who will fill that airtime with stuff that they will maybe throw back at your organization and be negative. And that was I've always been taught that in crisis communications is try, have someone who can speak and give the company's views. Because if not, there'll be someone who will say something negative instead about you. So just try that. So yeah, it was difficult, a really difficult time.
Moving forwards, you go to next Olympics is 2016 Rio. How was the preparation for that? Because things almost went bankrupt.
And with Philip and Xavi, gave me this amazing opportunity. I mean, the IPC at the time was 30 people. Moving to Bonn was unbelievable. Like to sell your house, say goodbye to your friends, say goodbye to your family. Move to a country that I knew Germany, but to go to a place where you think, I don't know anyone in this city, and you've got to restart your life. And it was in the hardest move I've ever done.
What was hard about it?
Well, just saying goodbye to everyone, like saying goodbye to your parents, your family members. It was really difficult. I'm thinking, God, I'm going to go there. I don't know where I'm going to live. Don't have any friends there. And it was just like a real move out of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And it's the best thing I ever did.
Especially given all that your parents sacrificed you. That's a strong relationship.
Totally,
there.
Totally.
And you have to leave them, you know, it might feel like leaving them alone.
Yeah, but they were again, and I knew my mother was really upset. But then they encouraged me to do it. Like, do it. It's the right thing for you. So, can we break there? So I can just have a bit of crying?
Yes, of course.
I told you I'd do this.
Well, look, that's what I mean. This is a place where it's feel free to be open and show your emotions. Be real, you know.
Always.
That's life. Tell us about the first 2 years. How was it the first couple of years?
So the first 2 years was...
I wouldn't say I was suicidal, but I felt like, I can't do this. I am losing it. My brain is not taking it in anymore.
So you make a step that you've never done before at this point, and you did talk. And you spoke to your...
Yes, my colleagues.
Your colleagues.
Yeah, yeah.
And you released and you cried in front of them on a Zoom.
And those guys are genius to me. Like them, they were very supportive. No, they were like, do not leave. Like, you can't leave. And they got worried in a way because they're like, no, you can't leave. And I was like, I was trying to almost, in my head, making an exit plan. I'm going to be like, you're going to do this. This is what I'm going to tell them. And
what happens?
I take deep breaths and deep breaths. I just said, I talked to my wife as well. I was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I'm losing it. Then I started putting a little bit of routine in my life. I was not doing exercising. I was not even going to a park. Like, I was just like constantly working, but my productivity was really bad because...
I mean, if you're working till 1 a.m. and...
Yeah, yeah. You know, I fell asleep on a laptop. Like, my head just...
So you woke up and you were asleep on a laptop.
It's like my neck is hurting. I started taking walk and taking deep breaths. I think that's like every time I'm like frustrated, just leave, take a deep breath, come back. Then I did a really crazy thing in my life I've never done. I had a paternity leave about 3 weeks. Then my second son was born during December, so and our office is closed for Christmas as well. Then I added a lot of holidays on it. Basic long story, almost for 2 months.
2 months off.
Yeah,
which you've never done before.
Yeah, never done before. And normally, because of the size of the team as well, I always had to check emails and stuff, like respond or do bits, like we own projects. I said, guys, I am switching off. I'm not looking at my laptops unless you call me. This is what you do while I'm away. This is like completely full trust in the team. You do the thing. And they did it. And it taught me a lot. Like,
what did you learn?
Delegation. And I think sometimes even as leaders, right, we end up doing things ourselves. Like,
Because it feels like, oh, I'll be quicker to do it myself, or I'll get it right if I do it myself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'll do it quicker. It'll take time to teach them. Or you say, like, it's too much of a problem to deal with this client. Let me throw myself in there. But in reality, you're making the biggest mistake. Because by you doing that, your team is not learning.
Taking an opportunity away from
them. Yeah, I think it's an opportunity, yeah. I mean, situations still create an opportunity to learn. So it helped me to mature up as a leader and let them do their own thing. Like they do, again, I am, like, you know, I said, I'm very opinionated. I do things in a certain way. Mm. Like I specifically let people do it their way. Whereas previously I would say, no. Here's a deck as an example presentation. Do this. No. I let them do it their way. Like, you know, a few of them, like, they delivered brilliantly. Client feedback is great. Where I actually thought, this is not the way I would present in my head, but I never told them this. But that's, it shows you there's no one right way, right? Especially with what we do. Everyone's got their own way, and I do believe in it. Mm. And that's what I meant by, you know, in other places, I felt like I was trying to be someone else, and you suppress yourself. Like, imagine the amount of effort you have to put psychologically to try to speak in a certain way. It takes from your thinking. Mm. And I always give the analogy of, if you were in a relationship with your partner, right? If you were trying to be someone else, that relationship will never, ever work, right? It will break at some point. And if you take it back to the work, you spend more time at work, technically, if you exclude the sleeping time, at work in a way than you do with your partner. And if you try to be someone else there, that is like the worst thing to do, right? You're like, but a lot of people of color do that as well. And I think homogenous communities, because you want to fit in. But I think you need to be yourself. That's where, like, regardless of your, and I think that's not just to do with the diversity spectrum of like ethnic minority or this. As a person, regardless of your race and stuff, you just need to, it's cliche to say, but be authentic.
Be your authentic self.
Because you perform the best, and that's what I've performed the best in this. Even in other roles, I got a lot of promotion, a lot of success. But I felt the best in this role because I put all the baggage aside, like, this is who I am, take it or leave it. And I just act the way I would act with my friend. You know what I mean? There's no second me. Mm. I feel comfortable.
So part of what you said there has become a bit of a theme that we've begun to see, that by leaving or taking a proper break, you can go back with a new energy and a new perspective.
Yeah.
And this has been shared to us by a few people across this podcast series. So I think there's a lesson definitely in there, that it is important, if you can, to take a break away, to renew your perspective, you know, because especially through the things that we've all been through. I remember lockdown as well. Charles and I, when we were setting up Unify, there was like weeks of intense calls, like literally you have half an hour for lunch. That's it. We're on Zoom back to back. I remember the first time we spoke to you was like 5:30 on a Friday evening. I remember it was a great conversation, but I remember that, and it was very intense, and you did have to look for how can you give yourself a break, because otherwise you'd wake up, the laptop's there, it might be 8:30, you open it, and then, you know, who knows when you're going to shut it again.
You like lose it, right? I think that during the COVID, that was the biggest challenge. It's like, where did the time go? And I was like, lunch? I was just like, just grab something. And it was like, you know, with the new way of working, it was like constant meetings. Mm. Being in a meeting, like video calls as well, for like 10 hours, is draining.
Mm. I think there's a great thing that you've brought back from your time off on a personal side that you still do now. Tell us about your children and story time.
Oh, yes. I've always been ambitious, right? And I guess it's the disadvantages I had when I was younger. So I was like, I need to be there, like be successful for my parents as well, like to make them proud. But that 2 months in particular, one thing that it reminded me of was, so what? Yes, I'm now senior, but if I don't spend time with my kids, if I don't see my family, you know, I don't want them to remember me as the dad who always worked. Like, that's what they're going to remember. They're not going to think of me as the dad who
became MD.
So I made a promise. Like, I think kids taught me being more productive and efficient. Like, so I made a rule to myself. Like, I said, look, bedtime in particular, like during COVID, I had to skip a lot of them with Zafira, our first one, and it really bothered me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, this work, but I don't have the time to do. So I prioritize work. But taking that break and reconnecting, especially, you know, with a newborn as well as Zafira, it was like, this is my like religious role almost. From 6:30 to 9, even if, unless someone's dying, which in most cases in our work line of work never happens, I am doing bedtime. I'm doing my son's bath time. You know, we read stories together, then we listen to stories as well. We sleep, he falls asleep, I come down. Family will always be there. And in any job that you work, even if you're the founder, if you're XYZ, you're always replaceable. But family is not. I had a lot of reflection during that 2 months. And I changed my way. I'm much happier in terms of what we do, how I operate. And I think my team is happy as well because I give them a lot more responsibility, a lot more. They learn a lot more. And I'm there not to poke and stuff. Like I grew as a leader where they trust me or they come to me themselves if they have an issue. So what should I do on this? We have this problem, can we fix it? How? And you know, another thing, let's say this year I took as a, you know, my parents are getting very old, like 70 plus, and I said, I used to go to Turkey once or twice a year. I was like, I'm gonna change this because my dad fell ill, and it again made me realize, you know, that touch wood, they might pass away and I'm gonna be like, I'm gonna kill myself not seeing them as often. So now I go every 2 months, every 3 months. It's a must. Like, it's not a choice. There is always something to do at work. I can, you know, take out my to-do list, there will be millions of things, but I think you have to take family and friends first. Not to say you ignore the work, and there will be times where you have to sprint, you know, sometimes. But it becomes, if it becomes a normality that you're constantly missing your kids' bedtime or you're constantly missing things to do with family, your weekends and everything, then that is not healthy. Mm. It's not sustainable. You will blow at some point.
I think that's great advice and a great example there for people who are driven, want to be successful, want to achieve, whether that's in business or their career, that you've got to remember the things that do really matter and get things in balance and think about, you know, at your funeral, they're not going to say, he increased the company by 200% in year one, and then year two, they doubled that. And it's going to be, you know, how he was as a father. Oh, he was never there, but, you know, he loved us. Or they're going to say, he worked hard, he provided, and he was there for us. He always made sure he's there for bedtime. Yeah. They will say that, you know.